In 2024, Americans lost nearly $750 million to romance scams.
Mm-hmm.
And the crazy thing is, the man responsible for a massive chunk of that wasn't hiding in some, you know, hacker bunker overseas typing furiously in the dark.
Right. He wasn't.
No, he was actually sitting at East Hartford, Connecticut, filing mundane corporate registration paperwork.
Welcome to another deep dive. We are so thrilled you're joining us today.
Absolutely.
So the mission for this deep dive is to explore the, well, the deeply disturbing and highly lucrative evolution of modern cyber confidence crimes. We're looking at a landscape that has totally abandoned obvious spam in favor of this highly sophisticated, corporate structured emotional manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, the whole paradigm of digital fraud has shifted completely. You know, the old tactics, they really relied on just a numbers game, casting this massive clumsy net. But what we are examining today is, it's a spear phishing operation that functions with the efficiency of a Fortune 500 company. It really does. And to unpack this for you, we are pulling from a really fascinating stack of sources. We aren't just looking at the official U.S. Department of Justice federal sentencing decrees.
Yeah.
We're cross-referencing those with a comprehensive investigative analysis of a multi-jurisdictional fraud syndicate. And we're grounding all of that with local news reporting from the East Hartford Gazette, just to see the actual, you know, the community impact.
Which is vital to really grasp the scope of this.
Exactly. And at the center of this web is a 30-year-old man named Nebranyan Aniagi Cobbold. From this quiet domestic base in Connecticut, he orchestrated a nationwide network that stole over $1.5 million. I mean, he ruined lives from coast to coast.
Coast to coast.
Yeah. But the most staggering part of his story isn't even just the theft itself. It's the sheer hubris of his downfall.
Mm-hmm.
It culminates in this self-produced music video where he quite literally spelled out his crimes in $100 bills.
It is a profound case study in criminal delusion, honestly. But to understand that downfall, we have to kind of deconstruct the machinery he built. We need to start at the end of the legal road.
Let's do it.
So on March 5, 2026, in a federal court in Des Moines, Iowa, Aniagi Cobbold was sentenced to 108 months. That is 9 full years in federal prison.
9 years. I mean, 9 years is a massive sentence for a white-collar wire fraud conviction.
It really is. And the court also mandated 3 years of supervised release and ordered him to pay over $1.55 million in restitution. The severity of that sentence from the Southern District of Iowa, well, it makes a lot of sense when you look at the national context provided by the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or the IC3.
Oh yeah, those IC3 numbers are just chilling.
Yeah.
Approximately 59,000 victims in a single year, resulting in that that $672 million loss we mentioned right at the top.
Staggering numbers.
Right. But let's clarify something for the listener. When we hear the phrase romance scam, I think a lot of us still picture the classic, you know, the 419 Nigerian prince email.
Exactly, yeah.
We think of poor grammar, these implausible stories about trapped gold, and some desperate plea for a $500 wire transfer. So why is a modern syndicate like Aniagi Cobbold's so much more dangerous than those old dragnets?
Well, basically because the syndicate operates like a modern tech company utilizing CRM, that's customer relationship management principles. In the early 2000s, an overseas scammer might send a million poorly written emails just hoping one lonely person clicked reply.
Right, it was just opportunistic.
Totally opportunistic. Today, these operations are highly targeted, and the geographical location, that is the linchpin. Historically, international fraud cells, they hit a wall when it came to American cultural idioms, and more importantly, the strict friction of domestic banking.
Wait, I want to stop you right there because that banking friction is such a crucial piece of this puzzle. Like an IP address in West Africa trying to open an American bank account or route funds, that's going to trigger an immediate block, right?
Oh, instantly.
But by operating out of East Hartford, Aniagi Cobbold just bypasses that geofencing completely.
That is the exact strategic advantage he had. He provided the overseas elements of the syndicate with a domestic, purely American proxy.
Wow.
Yeah. When a bank looked at the IP address logging into the account, it was a Connecticut IP. When a victim looked up the mailing address, it was a real street in East Hartford. He basically provided a veneer of unfiltered legitimacy that just allowed the money to flow.
Okay, so setting up a domestic proxy gets you past those geographical security blocks, but you still have a massive logistical problem. Before you can launder the money, you have to convince someone to actually send it to you. And, you know, they aren't running television commercials. How are these modern syndicates actually pulling people into the funnel?
They weaponize the most fundamental human vulnerability we have, which is the need for connection. And this brings us to the victimology of the case, which is just devastating. The investigative analysis details how these syndicates use internet dating sites and social media platforms to hunt.
And hunt really is the appropriate word here.
It is. They are not picking targets at random. They focus overwhelmingly on the elderly or individuals who are living on fixed incomes.
So we are talking about retirees.
Right.
Widows. Widowers. People who have significant, albeit liquid, life savings, but who are experiencing high degrees of social isolation.
Exactly.
The Department of Justice decree from the Southern District of Iowa, it highlights one specific victim who lost over $400,000.
A lifetime of labor and savings just wiped out. And we really have to explain the mechanism here because this is not a quick transactional theft. You know, no one is hacking a password and draining a 401k overnight. The clinical term for this process is emotional hijacking.
The sources mention that scammers calculate a target's exploitability score. I found that phrase terrifying. I mean, how does a criminal in a syndicate actually calculate an exploitability score? Are they just, you know, guessing based on a Facebook profile picture?
No, it is far more systematic than that. Scammers use the data footprints we all leave online. They look at public posts in grief support groups. They comb through keywords related to recent loss, loneliness, or isolation.
So they're basically doing data mining on grief.
Exactly. If a user frequently posts late at night about missing a deceased spouse, or if their social media shows a sudden lack of family interaction, their quote-unquote score goes up. The syndicate then spends weeks, sometimes months, grooming the target based on that highly specific data.
So they are building a bespoke persona. Like if the victim's digital footprint shows they love golden retrievers, classical music, and traveling to Italy, the scammer's fabricated profile suddenly reflects this deep, lifelong passion for dogs, Bach, and Tuscany.
Precisely. They create a perfect mirror. And this is where the psychology of emotional hijacking really takes hold. The scammer isn't just being friendly, they are intentionally filling an emotional vacuum. They text good morning every single day, they send voice notes. Yeah, they become the victim's primary source of daily dopamine and emotional validation. They create an intense dependency.
And I imagine once that dependency is locked in, the sunk cost fallacy just takes over. The victim has invested so much time and emotion into this digital relationship that to question it would mean admitting they've been fooled, which is psychologically unbearable.
That is the exact vulnerability the scammers exploit for the ask.
Right.
Notice that the initial request for money is almost never framed as a handout.
Right.
It is presented as a logistical hurdle preventing their ultimate physical unification. The scammer will claim, you know, their passport is held up by a corrupt customs official, or a sudden catastrophic business emergency overseas is freezing their assets right before they were supposed to fly to the United States to marry the victim.
So they fabricate a crisis where the victim is the only possible savior.
Exactly.
And the fallout from this, as detailed in the sources, is catastrophic. I mean, we aren't talking about people wiring a few hundred stare dollars.
Not at all. Victims drained their 401k accounts. They emptied IRAs, taking massive early withdrawal penalties just to access the cash. They liquidated life insurance policies.
The investigative analysis noted that victims sold the homes they raised their children in. They sold their primary vehicles. They borrowed heavily from friends and family, just burning their real-world support networks to the ground to send money to a phantom.
We are looking at a demographic of people in their 70s and 80s who are suddenly forced to abandon their retirements and re-enter the workforce just to keep the lights on. The financial devastation is absolute.
But the local reporting from the East Hartford Gazette, it really leans into the invisible toll, right? The emotional destruction. There is an intense, paralyzing shame that follows the realization of the scam.
Oh, the psychological damage often outweighs the financial ruin. Just imagine the cognitive dissonance. You believe you are in a deeply loving, reciprocal relationship. Then the illusion shatters and you realize the person you loved was actually a corporate syndicate operating out of Connecticut.
It's sickening.
It is. The victims often experience severe social withdrawal. They isolate themselves from their real families out of embarrassment, and they suffer a permanent loss of faith in any digital or phone communication.
It is predatory on a level that is just hard to stomach. But, you know, as we pivot back to the mechanics of the crime, I keep hitting this logical wall. Tricking someone into sending money is a psychological feat. But moving that money is a technical one.
Right.
Like if my bank sees me try to buy a $500 television in a different state, they freeze my debit card instantly.
Yeah.
How on earth is an elderly person in Iowa wire $400,000 to a 30-year-old's personal checking account in Connecticut without the anti-money laundering algorithms shutting the whole thing down?
Well, the short answer is, if the victim tried to wire $400,000 to the personal checking account of Nabanyan Anyagai Kobold, the transaction would be flagged and frozen immediately.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. The U.S. banking system relies heavily on the Bank Secrecy Act and Know Your Customer, or KYC, regulations. Algorithms monitor personal accounts for large, out-of-character transfers.
So how did he bypass the algorithm?
He put on a corporate suit. He registered a business called Alpha Distributions, LLC.
Wait, I need to push back on this. Anyone can just go online and register an LLC in Connecticut. Doesn't the state do any background checks if millions of dollars are going to be routed through this entity?
The barrier to entry for forming a limited liability company in many states, including Connecticut, is shockingly low. It requires filing articles of organization, paying a nominal fee, and naming a registered agent. There is no rigorous financial background check required just to form the legal entity. The state assumes the entity is being formed for legitimate B2B commerce.
Which is exactly the assumption the banking algorithms make.
Exactly. When a bank's automated system sees a $50,000 wire transfer from an individual to another individual, it triggers a risk alert. But when that same system sees a $50,000 transfer paying a business invoice to Alpha Distributions, LLC, the algorithm categorizes it as standard commercial activity.
Ah, because businesses move large sums of money every day.
Right. The LLC acts as a cloak of invisibility against automated fraud detection.
Wow. Now, the sources mention a co-defendant, Nenetakiwa Adonu, who's actually scheduled for sentencing on July 16th, 2026. What was the dynamic there? Was Anyagai Kobold just passing orders down to a low-level money mule?
Not at all. The prosecution established that Anyagai Kobold was operating as a middle-tier manager within the syndicate. He wasn't just moving money, he was running a masterclass in corporate fraud. He actively mentored and coached Adonu on exactly how to navigate the state registries, set up these shell entities, and open corporate bank accounts without triggering KYC protocols at the branch level.
So he was the critical hub. He connected the digital front end, the fake romantic personas grooming victims, with the physical back end, which is the asset acquisition and money laundering.
Precisely.
And what I found so insidious in the investigative analysis is that they didn't just use the LLC to fool the bank software. They weaponized the corporate identity directly against the victims.
Yeah, this is a masterstroke of psychological manipulation. When you have a victim who is hesitating, who is anxious about wiring their life savings, the syndicate doesn't just beg. They send an official, highly professional B2B invoice.
Let me get this straight. So the victim receives a PDF with a corporate logo, an EIN number, and official payment instructions to a registered U.S. company.
They do. It bridges the gap between the emotional manipulation and the terrifying reality of parting with cash. If the victim's quote-unquote fiancé claims he needs money for a massive shipping container of goods to clear customs, an official invoice from Alpha Distributions, LLC provides a tangible, comforting paper trail. It gives the victim permission to believe the lie.
But here's the problem with building a fake corporate empire. An LLC handling millions of dollars of unexplained untaxed income eventually creates an anomaly that a human investigator, not an algorithm, is going to notice. What happens when the FBI comes knocking and asks to see the foundation of this house of cards?
Well, a rational person, upon receiving a federal grand jury subpoena, might secure legal counsel and exercise their Fifth Amendment rights. But any guy cobbled attempted an incredibly bold and frankly absurd cover-up.
Okay, let's get into that. The FBI, Omaha Cyber Task Force, and the Polk County Sheriff's Office had been tracking the money from the Iowa victim. They followed the digital breadcrumbs right to his doorstep in East Hartford. And instead of remaining silent, he sat down with federal agents and doubled down on the mirage.
He did. He claimed Alpha Distributions, LLC was a highly successful, entirely legitimate export business. He told investigators he was sourcing consumer electronics and shipping them to buyers in Africa, which supposedly accounted for the massive influx of wire transfers.
But he didn't just say it. He handed them a stack of forged documents, fake invoices, fake shipping receipts, completely fabricated B2B correspondence.
Which is a catastrophic legal blunder. In the federal system, providing forged documents to a grand jury isn't just a poor defense. It's a separate crime. It's obstruction of justice. But beyond the separate charge, it provided the prosecution with the most powerful tool imaginable. It gave them undeniable proof of his consciousness of guilt.
Explain consciousness of guilt for us. If I hand over fake documents, doesn't my defense attorney just say, well, my client is a bad record keeper?
Bad record keeping is disorganized. Forgery requires intent. By taking the time to fabricate specific invoices designed to match the exact dollar amounts of the stolen funds, Aniak Guy Cobbold proved to the jury that he knew the money was illicit.
Right.
You don't forge shipping receipts for legal income. It demonstrated his deliberate, calculated intent to defraud the federal government.
It's the equivalent of getting pulled over for a broken taillight. And instead of taking the warning, you hand the officer a driver's license you clearly manufactured on your home printer. You take a routine inquiry and elevate it to a felony. But the FBI didn't just look at the paper and laugh. They used banking metadata to dismantle his story entirely. What exactly is the metadata in this context? Are we talking about IP logs?
Metadata is essentially the data about the data. It's the digital footprint of a transaction. The FBI wasn't just looking at the dollar amounts, they were looking at the precise timestamps, the routing headers, and the communication logs from the social media platforms.
Oh, so they cross-referenced the lie.
Exactly. Investigators correlated the exact moment a supposedly legitimate electronics purchase, wire transfer, cleared the Federal Reserve with the exact timestamp of the romance scam communications happening on the victim's phone.
So the prosecutor can stand in front of a jury and say, look at this timeline. At 2:00 p.m., the victim receives a frantic WhatsApp message begging for exactly $33,250 to pay off a corrupt customs official. At 2:15 p.m., the victim authorizes the wire. At 4:30 p.m., the funds land in Alpha Distribution's account, and the defendant claims this exact amount was actually a down payment for a pallet of laptops.
The timeline makes the coincidence mathematically impossible. The metadata was the ultimate lie detector. It proved the export business was a total fabrication from top to bottom.
But incredibly, the forged documents and the metadata weren't even the climax of the trial. There is a piece of evidence in this case that feels like it was written by a satirist. It doesn't belong in a federal sentencing decree.
You were referring to the music video.
Yes, the self-produced music video. During the act of conspiracy, while he is methodically draining the life savings of elderly Americans and ruining generations of wealth, Nabanian and Ajay Cobbold decides to step in front of the camera. He shoots a high-definition music video and titles the song, literally, SCAM.
It is a breathtaking display of hubris. The lyrics of the song were a direct confession. He rapped openly about the mechanics of the crime. He bragged about receiving scam money, about laundering it up and living lavish while the money was coming in.
And the visuals, I mean, he wasn't just rapping into a microphone in a studio. The video features him posing next to a luxury vehicle. And on the hood of that vehicle, he had painstakingly spelled out the word scam using massive stacks of $100 bills. What possesses a criminal to do this? Is it just pure ego?
It is ego, but it is also a psychological phenomenon we frequently observe in modern cybercrime. There is a profound delusion of invulnerability that comes from the distance of the internet. When a criminal is operating behind a screen, bypassing complex banking algorithms with a few clicks, they begin to mistake the anonymity of the web for actual invincibility.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, they believe that because they outsmarted a bank's automated KYC filter, they are untouchable by the physical justice system.
He thought he was playing a video game where the points just happened to be real dollars.
Exactly. He completely misunderstood the reality of modern digital forensics. And from an investigative standpoint, this video was the holy grail. Cybercrime is notoriously difficult to prosecute because defense attorneys will often argue that while a computer at a certain IP address committed the crime, the prosecution cannot definitively prove who was sitting at the keyboard.
They use the, it wasn't me, someone hacked my Wi-Fi defense.
Precisely. But this video directly, physically linked Aniagai Cobbold's face, his voice, and his sudden, unexplained influx of massive wealth directly to the criminal proceeds. He did the prosecution's job for them. He provided a time-stamped, high-definition confession of the money-laundering operation.
I keep thinking about the sentencing phase on March 5th. Imagine the atmosphere in that federal courtroom. The prosecution plays this music video. On one side of the room, you have victim impact statements from elderly citizens who are weeping because they have to sell the homes they've lived in for 40 years. People whose dignity has been stripped away.
Right.
And on the massive screens in the courtroom, you have the man who stole their security, throwing their money on the hood of a car and dancing.
It is the ultimate insult to injury. And legally, it served a very specific purpose for the prosecution. When a judge determines a sentence, they look for acceptance of responsibility or any sign of remorse. The prosecution used this video to demonstrate a complete, almost sociopathic lack of remorse. It showed the judge that the defendant viewed the destruction of his victims' lives as a joke, a prop for his ego.
Which perfectly explains why the judge brought the hammer down with a 108-month sentence. The judge realized there is no rehabilitating this mindset without severe, prolonged intervention.
The video made leniency impossible.
So the gavel comes down 9 years in a federal penitentiary. But what is the tangible aftermath of this?
Yeah.
The court ordered $1,554,442.46 in full restitution, down to the exact penny. But let's give the listener a reality check. Ordering restitution and actually collecting it are two very different things in the world of cybercrime, aren't they?
The reality is incredibly bleak. The court order is vital. It is a formal, legal acknowledgement of the harm caused to the victims, and it places a permanent financial judgment against the defendant. But collecting those funds is nearly impossible. These syndicates do not leave the money sitting in an American savings account.
Right, because if it were sitting in an account, the FBI would have just frozen it and seized it.
Correct. The assets are rapidly liquidated. They are spent on the lavish lifestyle bragged about in the video, luxury cars, high-end real estate, designer goods, or more commonly with modern syndicates, the funds are immediately pushed offshore. They are converted into cryptocurrency, tumbled through anonymous wallets, or wired to jurisdictions that do not have extradition or banking treaties with the United States. Once the money crosses those specific borders, it is gone. The tragic truth is that these victims will likely never see the majority of their life savings returned.
That is a bitter pill to swallow. But there is a secondary action here that the East Hartford Gazette reported on, which I found fascinating from a legal strategy perspective. The state took civil action against the corporate entity itself.
Yes. The state petitioned for the legal dissolution of Alpha Distributions LLC in the Superior Court of Hartford. They schedule a show cause hearing for April 20, 2026. This is where criminal law intersects with civil corporate law.
Why bother dissolving the LLC if the guy is already going to prison for 9 years?
Because the LLC is a legally distinct entity. If it remains active, other members of the syndicate, or even Anaya G. Cobbold acting through a proxy from prison, could theoretically continue to use the corporate name, the EIN, and the established credit history to open new bank accounts or issue new fraudulent B2B invoices. By forcing the legal dissolution, the state is salting the earth. They are permanently dismantling the vehicle used to perpetrate the fraud.
They are burning the fake storefront to the ground so no one can ever walk into it again. And this ties directly into the 3 years of supervised release that follows his prison sentence. What does supervised release actually look like for a cyber criminal? It's not just a probation officer making sure he has a job, right?
Far from it. Supervised release for a wire fraud conviction of this magnitude involves intense digital monitoring. His internet usage will be heavily restricted. He will likely be required to install monitoring software on any device he owns, allowing the probation office to track his keystrokes, his web traffic, and his financial transactions.
The goal is to ensure he can't hop on a computer the day he gets out and register Beta Distributions LLC.
Exactly. The supervision is specifically designed to prevent him from returning to the environments where he committed the crimes, social media platforms, dating sites, and state corporate registration portals.
I want to pivot slightly and address you, the listener, directly. As we've gone through the mechanics of the crime, the banking loopholes, and the hubris of the criminal, the core vulnerability remains human. Think about your own older relatives, your parents, your grandparents, or a neighbor you check in on. How do we spot the subtle signs of emotional hijacking before the bank accounts are drained? The FBI's advice is to cut off contact and alert financial institutions immediately if a scam is suspected. But recognizing the scam is the hardest part.
It is the hardest part because the victim is psychologically incentivized to protect the scammer. They are deeply invested in the reality of the relationship. They will actively defend the scammer to their own children or friends. Therefore, the warning signs are almost always behavioral before they are financial.
What should we be looking for?
Look for sudden, intense secrecy regarding a new online relationship. Is your relative constantly checking their phone but refusing to say who they are messaging? Are they making elaborate defensive excuses for why this new partner can never meet on video or in person? Do the conversations suddenly shift toward unique, high-yield international investments or sudden B2B emergencies overseas?
The moment the digital relationship introduces a physical crisis that requires capital, the red flag should go up. and there are vital resources available. The FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, the IC3, is the primary reporting hub. State Attorney General offices also have dedicated consumer protection divisions. Even if the victim feels a paralyzing sense of shame, reporting is crucial. Every single report gives investigators another IP address, another routing number, another digital breadcrumb to track down the next domestic hub.
We have to remove the stigma of falling for these scams. When victims understand that they weren't fooled by a single smooth talker, but rather systematically manipulated by a highly organized, corporate-structured syndicate using advanced CRM tactics, the shame begins to lift. Open conversation is the most effective defense mechanism we have.
Let's pull all of this together. We started with the insidious, algorithm-driven grooming of lonely individuals online. We moved to the highly sophisticated corporate layering of an East Hartford LLC designed specifically to bypass the AML algorithms of the U.S. banking system. And we ended with a massive federal prison sentence secured, astonishingly, by a self-produced music video that treated the destruction of elderly lives as a point of pride.
It is a profound modern tragedy documented by a very modern digital paper trail. But if we pull back and look at the trajectory of this technology, it raises a deeply unsettling question for the near future.
What's that?
The absolute devastation caused by Nabanyan and Yagi cobbled, the millions stolen, the homes liquidated, the retirements ruined, all of that emotional hijacking was achieved using text-based messaging, stolen static photos, and perhaps a few voice notes. We are currently crossing the threshold into an era of readily available, hyper-realistic artificial intelligence and deepfake technology.
Oh, wow. The implications of that for this specific crime model are terrifying.
What happens to our emotional defenses when the fabricated persona doesn't just send a text but can initiate a live FaceTime call? When the victim can see a perfectly synthesized AI-generated face speaking with a cloned, realistic voice responding in real time to their questions? When the scammer's proof of life is visually flawless?
Our internal compass for verifying truth is based entirely on seeing and hearing. If those senses can be perfectly hijacked by an algorithm, how will we ever verify who we are truly loving in the digital age? That is a chilling thought to mull over, and a stark reminder of why understanding the mechanics of these syndicates is so vital. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the corporate evolution of cyber confidence crimes. Keep questioning what you see, stay vigilant, and keep exploring.